Hey, John. Ground control to Major John. Wake up.
Oh, I must have nodded off.
Well, that's an understatement.
I usually don't sleep till I get on the plane. Not so much in the Admiral's Club.
That's okay. Now that you've rejoined the living, you want to talk about the next series of opening sketches?
Sure, but I had the strangest dream. We found the remains of a data consultant while digging under a building in 2126. We witnessed the AI upheaval of 2041, and we helped some guy back in the 90s who was building the company's first data warehouse. It all seemed so real, and...
And there was NM and Hickory and Zeke.
And a talking moose.
Let me smell your breath.
Stop that. Maybe we could do some kind of a timey-wimey travel arc.
Sounds cheesy.
Right, up our alley.
Why not, assuming we can't come up with anything better? We also need to line up guests. Maybe we can follow up with some of the people we met at DGIQ.
Hey, you the guys that do the rock bottom data feed?
Yes, we are. How'd you know?
I recognized your voices. Good show. Good information. And yins don't take yourself too seriously. Well, thank you, Mark. I think we found our listener. But yins got to work more on sales and marketing. I see a lot of companies and the way they treat data is criminal. The way I look at it, if you don't take advantage of free stuff, you're being dumb. And when it comes to companies and data, there's a lot of dumb.
You should be a guest on the show.
No. I try to keep a low profile.
Do you always travel with your own soundtrack?
Of course. You see that guy over there?
Yeah.
That's someone you need to talk to. His name is Marvin Hindenburg. He's the chief data officer at the totally modest but awesome AI company. They're knocking it out of the park when it comes to AI.
But let me guess, they're totally modest about it.
That name sounds familiar.
How do you know him?
He started out at Consolidated International way back in the 90s. They say he was a data governance prodigy, but the company went in a different direction. Too bad for them. Years later, let's just say the company got into some trouble and I got called in to identify the body. But they're still in business. I see commercials all the time, and it seems they have a press release about some new AI breakthrough every couple of weeks. Smoke and mirrors, my friend. It's all built on a foundation of nothing. Diddly squat. Maybe they'll get lucky, and it all works out okay, and maybe they won't. I know which way I'm betting. But this Marvin guy, he's the real deal. He signed on with Slate Technical Solutions and put together the best corporate data and analytics program I've ever seen. And he got the governance part right. I'm surprised I haven't heard of them. Slate, is it? Especially with such great data governance? I think he'd be all over the speaking circuit. They do mostly government work. Hush, hush. They just spun off a consumer AI division.
836 non-stop service to Pittsburgh with connections to Boston, New York, and Philadelphia.
Well, guys, that's my flight. Good luck to you. All passengers, please. One more thing. Do you know a Bob Twitt?
No.
Why? Just been trying to track him down. If you happen to run across him, let me know. Here's my card.
Nick Guy, data detective. Thanks. Let's go introduce ourselves.
Hi there. Are you Marvin Hindenburg?
I am. And you're John Ladley and Mark Cooper.
Well, I'm Mark and he's John, but yeah.
I listen to your show. I mean, you'd have to be dumb not to take advantage of free stuff. And it really helps.
I think we found our second listener.
We thought we'd ask if you wanted to be a guest on the show. We heard you've been making some real breakthroughs in AI and data.
I'd love to. And yes, we are.
Now, how'd you make it happen?
It started a long time ago when I worked for Consolidated International. We just launched our data warehouse initiative, and the strangest thing happened. I was supposed to have a meeting with Big Five Consulting. I mistook two other consultants that arrived early for them, but that 30 minutes changed the entire trajectory of my career. You know, you guys kind of remind me of them. But then, that was 30 years ago.
You know, I thought
the idea was to focus first on people and process, to understand the data before turning it loose into the wild, so to speak. Unfortunately, Consolidated wasn't interested in that approach. I can't tell you how many times I heard, just get me the data and I'll figure it out. I knew that wasn't sustainable, so I left. Consolidated didn't do so well after that.
We heard.
I mean, it wasn't because I left.
No, we know what you mean.
So I joined Slate Technical Solutions precisely because they were receptive. We built our analytics program around Fugu.
A Japanese pufferfish sushi?
Right. Fugu. Find. Understand. Get. Use. With the emphasis on the understand.
Plus, if you don't prepare the data right, you get sick and die.
20 years ago, we didn't know what the next big thing would be, but I knew that whatever it was, we'd be ready for it. 10 years ago, it was big data. Now it's AI.
I hear the AI division just got spun off.
Yes, it did.
Does that mean you can talk more about data governance done the right way?
It does. In fact, I'm on my way to speak at a conference in Ireland.
You mind if we trade contact information?
Not at all.
There we are.
And you?
Thanks.
I look forward to talking with you more, and we'll definitely be in touch about the show.
Will do. Thanks.
Well, there we go. One guest for the fall series.
You're not going to believe this, but...
You're probably right.
All right, that's a wrap.
This is John Ladley.
And Mark Cooper.
Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
You know what they say? The best time to start doing data governance is 30 years ago, and the second best time is today.
And the contrast between companies that get it
and do it
and do it and those that don't is stark.
You know, maybe if the government got involved.
Funny you should mention government. Today we continue our conversation with Sam Spencer, CEO and founder of Aristotle Metadata out of Australia. In this episode, we dive into some work he's been doing with the Australian government.
We'll let Sam give the details, but the short version is that the Australian government spent a whole lot of money on a data initiative and didn't have a whole lot of results to show for it. Sam's helping them to make better progress without having to handhold the whole time.
Sam will also play our famous game show. And of course, we'll have all the favorite segments like the 8-bit consultants and the data poetry slam.
And John's monologue.
Yeah, right. You too. Sadly, I looked at LinkedIn this morning. As usual, there's stuff out there that troubles me. This time, it troubled me to the point where I have to talk about it. Let's start with a takeaway. Nothing's changed. If I look at the words from a reliable, wise, experienced source, I get information about how to be successful with my AI or my data. If I look at words from a passionate but inexperienced young person, I also get good advice, but a QT diagram generated by AI to help make the point. The experienced person has come there through wisdom and knowledge acquired over years. The upstart can sit down and sit with ChatGPT for a little while. All of this advice has been out there for 30 damn years. Remember the definition of insanity? See, this is a disease. When we have two levels of experience like this saying the same thing, we're repeating ourselves. We've missed the point. We're still missing the point. We have to get away from dated cliches. We have to get away from doing things the same way again and again. Quit looking for a pigeonhole to find in the answer. Put your architecture in it. Put your approach in it. There is no do it this way and we'll be successful, he said in air quotes. What really matters is looking in the mirror and telling yourself this is a people thing. This is way bigger than you want to admit. Every time I do this monologue, I end by saying, be nice to each other. I'm going to change that up a bit. For this last monologue of our series, I'm going to say, be nice to yourself. Step back, look at this problem from 50,000 feet. You will discover that we say the same things about everything in data over and over. I put together a checklist as a lark to look at all these cliches up front. It works great. We get all of the standard stuff out of the way, then we get to the hard part, which is the culture stuff. Success is hard. Change is hard. Be nice to yourself and each other.
We now continue our conversation with Sam Spencer. As someone who did AI back in the 1990s, where you could have a neural network with 100 parameters and do a couple of generations overnight, I remember the first time I saw a data robot, and it worked through hundreds of models, tens of thousands, millions of parameters. And I think there's a possibility for that. And there's potential for that in this area where we don't have to spend so much time. Let AI come up with the ideas for our metrics and test them out. Again, with data robot, it's going to try hundreds of models that aren't going to work super well. And it's going to prune those off, and it's going to focus on the ones that seem to be doing good. Well, here we have a whole bunch of metrics, and let's see which ones do well and which ones have good predictive power and focus on those. And we're getting to the point where we could actually implement all that faster than we could have the conversation that you just described.
And I think like that kind of goes to the question of like why do we keep producing these metrics? And that actually came up a lot, you know, when I was going through the MBA is you hit on like predictive analytics and just kind of sense checking what an organization's doing. And I think that's where there's this purist view versus, you know, what do we do to get the business moving forward is if you have a crappy measurement for number of users, but that number keeps going up, then that has value, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's where we need to recognize it is go, well, if we can use that number to understand the business better, how good does that metric actually need to be if it's helping us analyze that? And I think one thing that may, you know, if you've got a coding background, Mark, I think one of my favorite arguments is like, you know, lines of code, you know, how many lines of code did an engineer write? How do you like, I think the fight comes up every couple of decades. Where do you stand on lines of code as a metric for engineers?
You use it when you can't think of anything better. Because my first computer was an Apple II Plus. And I learned programming by typing in code from a magazine. And every month in the magazine, they had the one-line program. And the objective was in 255 characters, one line of AppleSoft Basic, to come up with a program that does something useful. And people did really interesting stuff in one line of code.
So you know? I used to agree with you. And recently, like especially with AI coming out, and I know we're getting further and further away from me talking about the dashboard, but we'll get back to it, is I think lines of code is actually a really good metric. We're just using it incorrectly and we're thinking about it incorrectly because a lot of engineers will think, and I used to think the same way, is if you want me to write more lines of code, I'll just write more lines of code. I'll just comment everywhere. You know, I can, yeah. I can make more lines of code. That's not a problem.
Oh, if you're gonna, saw through how I did it. Oh dear.
Yeah.
That's what we did, right?
Top of the class every time.
Yeah. You know, like I'll just oop the crap out of it. We'll just put lines everywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're tracking me a number of bugs closed, I'll just close lots of small bugs and I'll make sure every line is a bug. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the difference between a metric as a target versus a metric as a measurement. Like, and I think this is where we failed to communicate what we were trying to do, because I think, again, MBAs love measuring output. And that was the thing that I learned is like what's happening in the organization so we can do stuff with it. What I think we failed to communicate with that and where I've kind of come to with this, especially with AI, is number of lines code kind of tells you how much stuff is happening in an organization. Not whether or not it's good or bad. It just tells you what's happening, right? And the example I use here is like, you know, we were writing a volume of code, you know, before AI coding took off, we were writing some code. And the assumption would be that we want to make sure every line of code is quality controlled, right? So there's a certain level of amount of effort that goes into writing the code and a certain amount of effort that goes into quality controlling that code through peer review or whatever. AI comes along and then all of a sudden everybody's saying, you know, and I read this thing that, you know, we're back to measuring lines of code again. It's back, you know, never dies. And all of a sudden we're writing 10 times the volume of code. My question as an executive is like, if you're writing 10 times more code, if there's 10 times more lines of code, but our ability to review that code has remained the same, that's a differential problem, right? Like, and this is why I think we need to be asking why are these metrics, so important is, if your organization is writing 1,000 lines of code a week per engineer, for example, and then all of a sudden 1 month it drops to 200 lines of code per engineer, you go, something's changed, right? It's not good, it's not bad, something's happened, right? And that's what I think we need to be looking at is like a lot of the time we're collecting data, it's really about over time what's happening in an organization. And I think the analogy here is, when the nurse takes the temperature, right? It's not about I'm taking the temperature every 15 minutes or every hour, and if they get too hot, I'll just throw some ice on them to cool them down. It's the temperature gives you an indication of something else that's happening in the body. If the temperature gets too hot, I don't want to cool them down. I want to give them, Panadol or Tylenol to help break their fever.
Right. It's a signal, not a evaluation, not
Exactly,
a
right? But I
metric.
think we never connected that, right?
We understand that this isn't all just an academic exercise. We could, I know it's a little early in the morning there for to talk over beers, but you have
Oh,
a
I'm Australian. We can
oh,
talk.
okay. We talk over beers anytime.
Took the words out of my mouth.
All
Okay.
right. You have a very high visibility experiment underway right now, and we're excited to hear about that. And so give us a story.
So as I said, like I think I think we need to redefine data owners to be asset owners. I think we need to, and I think we need to put that in, as you said, high visibility. How do we showcase this? So the experiment that we're running is, looking at, the Australian Government Data Catalogue, which is a very public data catalogue, and as I spoke about in my Dataversity talk, and as you'll read in the newspaper, this has been a 4-year government department that's trying to find and catalogue data assets across the entire Australian federal government landscape, right? What is government sharing with all these organizations, with academia, across government, state governments, local councils, private sector? What data do we have and who are we sharing it with? Collectively, it was about $200 million over those years, and they serviced 34 data requests over 4 years for $200 million, and they found 505 data assets. Before we continue, guys, do you think 505 data assets for the entirety of the Australian federal government is enough?
No, not a bit. Not a bit. This is, I was automatically doing the maths between over 4 years, 4 requests, 505, 200 million.
Requests, yeah.
And even in Australian dollars, that's a lot of money. So,
Right. It's, yeah, like, well, yeah. In Australian dollars, it's a lot of money. So we could talk. For the rest of this talk, we've got, 20 minutes scheduled left. We could talk for, 20 minutes, 20 hours on defining data, right? Like we could spend a lot of time trying to come up with the best definition of data, but I think we can both agree that there's no definition of data where 505 across the entire federal landscape makes sense. And that's what this is about, is going, well, how do we bundle this up, right? The other thing that I think is really important there is we looked at it from a departmental level, right? So we said, who's the owners of these, right? Who are the people who are responsible for this? And that's where we came to things like the examples that I like are things like the Australian Tax Office has one data.
well, I can see why you say this is, there's a media connection here. This is a juicy story with all
It
that
is.
money going away.
Well, it's. It just kind of speaks to like I think something went wrong, right? I think something went wrong because we weren't kind of talking about this in the right way, in the right forum. So there's examples that we can look at there where, there's a couple of different agencies who only had one, and I'll talk about one specifically in a second as a success story. The other thing that was important is they went off and just like we were talking about with standards and schemas earlier, they came up with their own 26 metadata attributes that they wanted for every data set. And then they immediately realized asking 26 questions of government was going to be too hard. So they narrowed it down to 10 core mandatory fields. And we could unpack those, right? They're public knowledge. Anybody who's interested can search ONDC mandatory fields. And we could argue that one should be optional and one should be mandatory. And we could have this really fun philosophical discussion. But at the end of the day, a group of senior data executives said these are the 10 mandatory questions. And the Department of Defense has done 99% of their mandatory questions, right? Is that enough?
99% of their 10 questions? Mandatory.
Well, for all of their data sets, across all of their data sets, they had, I think it was 60-something data sets. There was 10 mandatory questions. So, you know, I think there's 600 questions that need to be filled in across these 60-something data sets, and 99% of those mandatory things have been done.
That's a metadata question. So what means mandatory?
Hey, thank you. Well, mandatory means all of them or right. not.
Well, I mean, like, I would say that it's mandatory that the bank locks the vault where my money is stored 100% of the time.
100%.
Is it okay if they lock the vault 99% of the time? We know where 99% of the tanks are. You know,
right.
like mandatory means mandatory. And
exactly.
that
99% of the sponges and sutures and.
Yeah. Like, surgery is successful 99% of the time. You know, like, and that's where I think it's the question is like, how do we communicate that to the executives is go, well, look, a bunch of smart people said these were the things that were mandatory, but mandatory is mandatory, right? These are the things that we have to have. And that's what we produced in this dashboard is to say, well, you know, looking at your rules, right? This isn't me being, you know, subjective. This isn't me being subjective at all or being mean. It's me going, well, you set up the rules and said, this is what we have to collect. And this is who's given you this information, right? And that's all the dashboard shows is it shows for each department, you know, who is the department? How much data have they actually put in? When was the record? What was the most recent record that was updated? Right? What was the most recent record that was updated? What percentage of mandatory has been done, and what percentage of optional has been done of the remaining 16? And that's really what it shows. And it's designed to surface questions like this, where you know, and I should have brought it up beside me, but I've memorized it by now. Where you know, it's things like you know, departments like our customs department, the Department of Home Affairs. They haven't updated any of their metadata in 2 years, right? And they've done 90% of their mandatory questions and about, you know, 60% of their optional questions. We don't need to dig into those metadata fields. We don't need to dig into the definition of data to look at it and go, well, if we've decided that these are mandatory, we need them to all be done, right? If we've decided that it's important for us to know what our data means, we can't be updating it every 2 years, right? We should be doing it more frequently than that. And that's where I think one of the things that I've encouraged the chief data officers across these departments to do is, even if nothing's changed in the data, I need you to go back and I need you to update the record with nothing so that I know that somebody's gone in and made sure that the record's updated. Because if nobody's doing that, if nobody's hitting that dead man switch, then we don't know that that record's still active, still updated, still important. And probably the last thing I'll say here is the I guess the core thesis is the data commissioner who set this up isn't responsible for those records. Like, they're responsible for a system that can hold them, right? But it's each of these departments. The ATO is responsible for making sure they're putting stuff in, right? The Department of Finance is responsible for making sure they're putting stuff in. That's where the responsibility lies for this metadata. And that's where I think, you know, we need to be encouraging chief data officers to think the same. It's like, their job is to govern the data, but it's not their data, right? Their job is to make sure that other people are doing their job. You know, if your finance department has data, what are they doing to fill it in?
I think one of the problems that comes up when you have centralized data teams is that they think that they have to do it all themselves, and the whole rest of the organization is perfectly happy to let them do it. Like, I don't want to do this stuff here. You do it. You seem to want to do it. I don't want to do it. And I'm convinced that the only way that this can be successful is by distributing that responsibility. And you know, we do it for security. Every manager at every company is responsible for going into the security database, you know, the permissions database, whatever it is, once a quarter, once a year, whatever the period is, and say, yes, this employee needs to continue to have access to these buildings or to these systems or to these data sets. And, oh, wait, this person doesn't work here anymore, so let's take them out of the database. And every manager is responsible for doing that. And I think people understand that when it comes to security, perhaps less so when it comes to understanding data.
I agree completely. Like, I think, and I think you've given me the best compliment of saying this is kind of obvious, right? Because we do it in so many other fields. Like, I think, again, to speak highly of Rob Sinor's work, I think he said almost verbatim, you know, everybody's a data steward. So how do we track that, right? And you're right. It's like security does this really well. Health and safety, I think, does this fantastically. And I think there are so many really good models out there for us to use. The thing that I think is missing is our ability to put that in front of an executive and say, you know, here's the issue, right? We're the experts in the room, right? And you know, I'd be, you know, interested, you know, and I know John was talking about doing a case study. I'd be interested to see what your opinion of those 10 mandatory fields is. But at the end of the day, when an expert like yourselves or you know, me maybe, just a guy like me, if we come in and say, these are the things that are important, they need to be done, right? And mm-hmm. and it's the example of the infectious disease nurse is we need to treat data teams like that to go out and go, well, I'm here to help you do better, because if you don't, I'm going to put a little red X against your department, and I'm going to let people know that this is happening. I had a call yesterday with a potential client who was like automation, and I said it's not going to work because people who are making data need to take responsibility of this. And he said, well, lawyers want to do lawyer things. They don't want to do data things. I'm like, well, I don't want to do health and safety things, right? I don't want to be filling out forms that say there's a spill in the kitchen. Like the one that I use at work, I hate time tracking. I have always resisted time tracking to its nth degree, right? But even I do it, right? I have to do it because if we're not tracking time, we're not invoicing.
The common thread that ties us all together is none of this is rocket science. It's been done in other professions. It's been done before. And we thought, to kind of tie us back before we move on to our next step here, we tied this back to asset as a metaphor. And it's not a metaphor. It's treat it like an asset that you're used to doing, and do things like health and safety, and do things like your timesheet, and wear your security badge, and learn what a budget is if you want to manage. I mean, none of this is new. It seems like it's a simple obstacle to overcome, but we're working on it.
Well, I think probably just to quickly close on that.
Sure.
One,
like yeah.
The reason it's hard is because it is new, right? I've been talking about this for a while, and I think, you know, alongside your book and alongside Rob's book, one day there's going to be a little book called Dynamic Data Governance written by me. And that's what the purpose of this case study with the data commissioner here in Australia is like, it's obvious, but it's never been done before. It's never been tested before. And what I say to a lot of people is like, and the reason that we're pushing this so heavily is I said to the data commissioner, when I spoke to them, I said, I want you to understand this isn't about a commercial victory. This isn't about me winning a contract with you or with any of these other government departments, right? I think when you show people transparently what's going on and you explain in simple language, like mandatory means mandatory. So I need you to do those things. Like I need you to tell me about your assets, ATO. So one's not enough. Right. We explain that to you know, the local newspaper, the you know, federal newspaper. And they were like, yep, that makes sense. And they're happy to report it because $200 million of waste for 500 data assets isn't enough. And so far, we've actually seen an improvement with no budget and no mandate. We're actually seeing improvements where people are putting more things in because they know they should be, and now there's someone reporting on it. And I think that, you know, that my hope is, you know, I think this will be successful, and I think you're both playing a part in it by telling the story and putting a spotlight on these chief data officers and saying it doesn't matter if you don't want to be the bad guy, you have to be the bad guy and get people to do this work. You have to tell them that this data has to go into this catalog. We have to have it complete. My hope is that, you know, in you know, like 10 months time, I'm back at Dataversity in San Diego, and we say, boy, howdy, that was tough, but it worked. And, you know, if you can non-invasive your way through, I think that's a really powerful message. But you also need to be showing the executives what's happening so that they can get their teams to follow up. You know, everybody's a data steward, you know, yes. How do we make sure that every executive understands that it's part of everybody's job and we show where the gaps are?
And the thing about that is you have the alignment of the measurement, the behavior, and the outcomes. And you have them all. So you've mentioned that you've described this as an experiment. Do we have results coming up soon?
We do. So I've been tracking it like and it's been getting more and more intense as we go through is there were a couple of private emails to people and I said, look, just FYI, this is going to a blog soon. And we have seen results. So at Dataversity I said there was a government department that misspelled all of their own email addresses. When that problem was highlighted to the chief data officer, it was fixed. They went in and fixed that, right? The Digital Transformation Agency was one of the ones that I think was called out by an audience member at Dataversity and said, digital should have more than one data. And now they have six, right? So they've actually gone in and tried to do more. So we've seen about a 5 to 10% improvement. I think there was some recent updates again, this week. So we are seeing an improvement. And I think we're going to see what happens next month. Because like I said, I think by the time this podcast drops, there'll be an accompanying newspaper in Canberra that will be basically delivered to the desk of each of these chief data officers that shows in red and green who's doing well. And what I know is, no executive, no public servant wants to see themselves ranked in a newspaper. So I think July is going to be a big month, but I don't know, right? I don't know, to be honest, guys. And that's what makes this an experiment is like, I think when you show an executive a ranking and show them who's not doing their job when it comes to data governance, they will change behavior, right?
Oh
And I
yeah.
think that,
Oh
like,
yeah.
and I think building that matrix, the Spencer matrix, as I'm calling it, because I get to do that, like the Spencer matrix, I think will be an integral part of data governance moving forward, so executives can see that. Because I think what we can do on a government level, department by department, is we can do that, department by department within an organization. And if we can change an entire government, ecosystem, if we can change an entire government data ecosystem with no budget and no mandate, and increasingly no friends because everybody's angry that I'm dragging them through the newspaper, that shows that it can work anywhere. Will it work? I don't know. Will it work? I don't know, but we'll find out. And if it works, I hope one of you writes the foreword to the book and says, boy howdy, that was a brave decision that was done. But we'll
Well,
see if it works.
one of us will write the foreword and the other one's going to buy it. So for sure, we're in really, really good shape. And we are looking forward to hearing next season about the outcomes of this. We have already planned to revisit with you
Absolutely.
and see how this goes. Sam, thank you just tremendously for talking with us for a bit of time. But before you go, we have two mandatory questions that we ask every single guest. Okay.
I might answer them.
All right. So, which individual, dead or alive, in your life has influenced you the most or the best, in your career?
Which individual has influenced me the most in my career, dead or alive?
Dead or alive.
Oh, all right. Can I do the second question first? Because I'm going to need some time to think about it.
Okay. All
I
right.
actually no, no. Actually no, no.
No,
I'm
this
going
is
to
a
submit.
first. This is great. We can do that unless you've got it all of a sudden it's popped into your head.
Like, give me a second to think about that one, and then we'll
All
do the
right.
second.
We'll edit the time out. We'll just do Jeopardy thing. That's all.
So
Two
what was
hours later.
I've got time to think about it. Okay. I think, what? I'm gonna give a shout out to my author. So when we developed the Masked and Ideal framework that was kind of influential behind where a lot of this thinking came from and kind of was talking about how we can communicate what people can do. I think I'm just gonna give a big shout out to Heather Riley, who is a colleague of mine at the ABS, who came from a psychology background, so it came from like a statistical, market research background, not from a technical background, and kind of challenged a lot of what I thought around how we do this. And I think she was the one who I would have to give a big shout out to around understanding why things are done in particular ways. Like I was doing some very similar shakeups when I was in the ABS, and she was probably the only person who listened out of everybody who didn't, and was a really big advocate at that point. We've remained really good friends for a long time, and I think we have ample disagreements around things, which is why I know about
Super.
as many as I do. So yeah.
They're the best. That's as people wonder how Mark and I get along. It's because we don't hardly agree on anything.
That's what a good friendship is.
But I would also, just add to the list that person who was telling you about not throwing the sheets around, because we never know. Because we all have people like that. We've all had a situation like that where somebody said something that had such a huge impact, and to them it was just, I'm sure that they forgot about it after 2 seconds. But for us, it ends up being a huge, and I know I have stories like that. John has stories. We all do. Ends up being something very significant. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think there's probably been, 10 people who could make the list. I should probably also shout out to my wife slash co-founder as well. But I think it's hard to pin it on one person and say who's been most influential. But for data governance, yeah, Heather.
Okay. Second question. You're going to hire a fella named Harry Potter, and he's going to cast one spell for you. And that spell will make whatever change in our industry you want to change. What would that spell be?
Oh, that's easy. That's actually really easy. I use a very similar example when we do our training, right? And I ask people, like, we go through this exercise and go, what do you need to know about your data? And generally, the four things that always come up are the name, the description, the location, and the owner of data, right? And I say, do you have those four things now? Like, could you reliably go to one place and look up the name, the location, the description, and the owner of data? And everybody says no. Everybody always says no. And I said, well, if I could wave a magic wand and make that happen, would you want that? And they say yes. I say that, and that's what I say, that that's what I think data governance can be, is encouraging people to do that proactively. I hope it doesn't need a magic wand, but I think for some people it does. Like, I'd say that. I'd say we need a magic wand that can just help people understand how to bring those simple things together.
Terrific. Sam, thanks very much for joining us on the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Look forward to having you back in a few months to hear about the results of your experiment.
Like I said, good or bad, I'm really excited to tell you what came out of it.
We'll talk soon.
Shout out to our supporter, Dataversity. Nobody knows everything, but when it comes to data, Dataversity comes close. Check out their training classes, webinars, and articles at dataversity.net and use discount code ROCK15 for 15% off your first purchase. Dataversity.net. These are dispatches from Rock Bottom, dredging up practical information, advice, and food for thought. For the past year, I taught introductory computer science at a local college. While I've done innumerable trainings, conference presentations, and guest lectures, it's been more than 30 years since I had my own class. I taught the first-year sequence to majors for 4 years in graduate school, and it probably doesn't come as a surprise to hear that in many ways the students in the 1990s and in the 2020s are similar. And in many ways, they're very different. But that's a subject for another time. As the last session before spring break was winding down, I gave the class an assignment. Set aside a half hour and be bored. Put down the phone, turn off the computer and the TV, take out the earbuds, go outside if you can, look around, sit, or walk. Call it meditation if you want to, just let your mind breathe. If anybody asks you why you're staring off into space, just tell them it's a class assignment, because it is. The feedback I got from the couple students who actually did it was that it was hard at first, and the half hour passed very, very slowly. Some people even sleep with the TV or radio on. Definitely not me, and are on the phone or computer the rest of the day. That's 24 hours of input every day. Some withdrawal is to be expected. One person told me that after a couple of days, she looked forward to her walks. They say that if you can really reach one person, you've been successful, and I guess I cleared that bar. So as the Rock Bottom Data Feed takes a break for the summer, I pose the same challenge to you. Take advantage of whatever break time you have by slowing down. Unplug. Read a book. One made out of paper. Fall will be here before you know it, and life will accelerate again. That's what I think. We'd love to hear your stories if you're willing to share. Write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
Sam, welcome back to our segment we call the Audio Rorschach Test, where instead of an ink blot, we use music because it's evocative, and we use royalty-free music because we have no money. So, Sam, I'm going to play a little bit of a tune for you, and we would like your immediate gut reaction in the context of our conversation, what this music makes you feel around our industry. Are you ready, Sam? Are you ready?
I am ready.
This is really, really amazing. Okay, here we go. Feeling, Sam?
I feel like this is my theme song walking into these conferences now, having taken the government to task. Yeah, like I think it's like this is like that's the kind of music I listen to amp myself up for these things, where you kind of having to convince people to change.
1950s Western music, yay! Let's hear. Sam, thank you again so much for being on the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Thanks for having me. Like I said, I don't know if I'm right. Like I think I love not being right. I love finding things out. Maybe we'll learn something new.
We'll learn what not to do. We always learn something new, and that's why we do this pod. So we'll talk to you in the fall, sir.
The 8-Bit Consultants. Advice in 256 characters or less. 4 times better than those 2-Bit Consultants. Today's question. My leadership is intractable. The new CEO is heads down, get things done. We're piling up data debt at an enormous rate. AI and analytics are high-risk pursuits, and any attempt at data discipline is met with violent stares. Help!
The answer seems odd. Listen, observe, document. When leadership executes the corporate playbook, all you can do is document. The data debt, excess risks, reverse decisions, and unhappy users. They will fail, and you have, frankly, covered yourself.
The 8-Bit Consultants. If you have a question in 256 characters or less, leave us a comment or write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
Some listeners may find the following frightening or offensive. Old white guy rapping. Once he built a data warehouse and delivered BI, but the answers weren't right, and I'm the fall guy. Ida Master was shit, so we gave MDM a try, and the numbers were still shit, and I was the fall guy. Here we go again. We have to do AI, spend lots of money, then find the fall guy. Thank you. Get off my lawn!
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Counterthreaded is not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that may arise from the use of this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast may not be those of the hosts or the management. This podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice. Any resemblance to actual events, entities, businesses, or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. Your mileage may vary. This concludes the 4th series of the Rock Bottom Data Feed. 36 episodes since we started. We'll be back later in the summer to find out how Sam Spencer's Australian government metadata experiment turned out. But in the meantime, go back and listen to our earlier shows. You'll find something useful and something entertaining. We've recorded over 21 hours of irreverent yet practical data-focused content that isn't a pile of technobabble and repetition of old advice. You could start season 1 on your flight from London and still be listening to this episode when you arrive in Sydney. Be sure to visit dataversity.net and use discount code ROCK15 to get 15% off your first purchase. Until next season, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening, and remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom. You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, more fuss about Sam Spencer, at our website, rockbottomdatafeed.com. The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a Counter-Threaded production, copyright 2026, all rights reserved.